Chapter 24 of the novel All Waiting is Long begins here in our area. Lily parked in front of the Century Club on Jefferson Avenue. She scanned the invitation once more before slipping it into her purse. Christian Ladies Society Lecture Series, Century Club of Scranton, Tuesday, November 19th, 1935, 3 o'clock. "Welcome," a gloved girl said, taking Lily's coat and handing her a program. "Enjoy the presentation." Lily thanked her and stepped into the ballroom, another breathtaking sight with its polished wood floors and impossibly high ceilings. Mrs. Silkman smiled, adjusted the podium, and began to speak. "On behalf of the Christian Ladies Society, I'd like to welcome Dr. Edward Peters to the Century Club." The doctor mindlessly stroked his beard while muffled applause rose from the gloved audience. Mrs. Silkman started again. "Dr. Peters received his medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania. He dedicated the first 12 years of his career to serving the poor unfortunates at Philadelphia's Good Shepherd Infant Asylum, where he delivered countless illegitimate children into this world. He currently practices medicine at Hahnemann Hospital and is a founding member of the American Eugenics Society. It is indeed an honor to welcome Dr. Peters as today's guest lecturer." Today's lecture, Dr. Peters pulled several rolled sheets of paper from his vest pocket and smoothed them out on the podium, is entitled Creating Heaven on Earth. "But I must confess, as I look over this crowd, I feel as though I've already arrived in God's kingdom. It is a privilege to stand before such wholesome ladies. The bloodlines in Scranton are strong. Before I go any further, I must apologize for my lateness." He pointed to his bruised left eye, "and in the process explain my unsightly injury. As is my habit, I arrived a day in advance of my speaking engagement. After settling into the Mayfair Hotel, I walked the streets of Scranton in an effort to get to know her better. But as I meandered back to the hotel, I happened upon such a shameful sight that I could not believe my eyes." He paused as if to prepare his audience for the shock to come. "Houses of ill repute, full city blocks of them. In fact," he continued, remaining in place, "so distressed was I by this corruption, I foolishly went out to one of these bawdy houses this morning, hoping to convince some of the women to repent. Instead, I received a blow to the face," he fingered his bruise, "from one of those so-called Johns." A sharp cry of sympathy rose up from the audience. "I'll be fine," the doctor smiled and patted his heart. "For although I'm not here to preach, what I have to offer today are God-inspired solutions for these troubling times. And may I say, this moral crisis is not limited to Scranton, Pennsylvania. Indeed, crime is running rampant across our great nation, and in order to stop its advance, in order to create a heaven on earth, people with moral fortitude must take up the mantle." "But, Dr. Peters," you say, "we're only women. What can we possibly do for the cause?" "More than you know, ladies. According to the American Philosophical Society," he glanced at his notes, 89% of crime is due to heredity. 89%! I've seen what happens when the feeble-minded reproduce, generation after generation of imbeciles. The same holds true for the depraved. Defects, be they physical, mental, or spiritual, are perpetrated through procreation. God never intended for defectives to survive. Before medical advances, nature used to dispense of them in the womb or upon birth. Careful breeding is God's design. Would a farmer mate a two-headed cow? I hardly think so. He'd be drummed out of town if he tried, someone shouted. No doubt, Dr. Peters chuckled. And when your husband buys a horse, what is his first question? Can you tell me about the bloodline? He'd be a fool not to ask. I hate to say it, ladies, but we put more thought into the bloodlines of livestock than babies. Bloodlines matter. Dr. Peters paused to smooth out his notes again. And it's up to you, fair women of Scranton, to take up the cause in your own homes. As the good book says, be fruitful and multiply. It's your duty as wholesome women to populate this city with the best and brightest of our race. Our race, he repeated, punctuating that first word with a nod. Keep our strongest bloodlines going. Help create heaven on earth. Heaven on earth, the Pentecostal woman repeated, and at least half of the ladies, many of them members, shouted, Amen. I have a pamphlet here from the Human Betterment Foundation entitled The Effects of Sterilization as Practiced in California, listing the benefits of what I'm suggesting. According to the foundation, sterilization prevents parenthood while allowing the defective patient to still perform matrimonial duties. Lily shifted in her seat, appalled by the doctor's message and the crowd's response. And be assured, sterilization is quite simple. Very effective methods have been developed specifically for women who are wanton or feeble-minded. Surgical sterilization renders a woman 100% infertile. No woman in her right mind would agree to that. As soon as the words flew out of Lily's mouth, all eyes were on her. You hit the nail on the head, my dear. No woman in her right mind, he smiled. There are times when sterilization needs to occur without a patient's consent. That's why our counterparts in Europe have developed less conspicuous methods to be performed immediately after labor, for those times when it's impractical to put a non-consenting woman to sleep. Lily couldn't help herself. The words kept overruling her good judgment. And are these methods legal? Not in all states. Not yet. He paused and smiled, giving that last word its full weight. Presently, it's inadvisable to engage in such practices without the weight of the law for protection. That said, I'm confident that any doctor brave enough to take up this fight has God's law behind him. Perspiration glossed Lily's brow as the truth worked its way to the surface of her mind. And have you, Dr. Peters, been brave enough to perform these less conspicuous methods? Many times, the doctor nodded confidently. Many times. Words from the novel All Waiting is Long by Barbara J. Taylor, a story set here mostly in Scranton and based on extensive research about eugenics the author conducted for the book, that a fictionalized account of the kinds of meetings that took place in the United States in the 1930s. Misericordia University is presenting a special program examining issues raised by eugenics beginning next week and running to the middle of March on the campus in Dallas just outside of Wilkes-Barre. Misericordia joins the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum to offer the provocative exhibition Deadly Medicine, Creating the Master Race, that outlines how Adolf Hitler was supported by medical doctors and researchers in his quest for advancing the Aryan race. The museum's traveling exhibition examines how the Nazi leadership, in collaboration with individuals in professions traditionally charged with healing and the public good, used science to help legitimize persecution, murder, and ultimately genocide. Misericordia is also holding a medical and health humanities deadly medicine speaker series to complement the exhibition. That is coordinated by Dr. Amanda Caleb, Associate Professor of English. Dr. Caleb and her colleague, Dr. Thomas Hykowski, Associate Professor of History at Misericordia, paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the Deadly Medicine Project.
We have a new medical and health humanities program that officially began this fall. So we have our first majors and minors already. And it's a collaborative effort between a lot of faculty over the last, say, 2 years, I think, to put together a really rigorous curriculum that prepares students for careers in medicine, health, really any of the allied health fields as well. And so partly to launch this brand new program, because there's really only two in Pennsylvania. There's only two majors in Pennsylvania, UPenn and us. We created this Deadly Medicine Speaker Series. So we approached the U.S. Holocaust Museum to bring the Deadly Medicine exhibition to Misericordia. It has not been in Pennsylvania in a very long time, if ever. I'm not even sure about that one. And so we brought it in. So it's here for 2 months, January through March. And in order to really utilize the space, we decided to create a speaker series. So we have a speaker a week for about an 8-week period, which was exhausting to put together, but I'm really excited to have some of our speakers to campus, including my dear colleague Tom, who will be one of our speakers. So we have people who are local, either affiliated with Misericordia or we have two rabbis from local synagogues, and we also have speakers from across the country.
It sounds like you're going to tell us what connections it might have to the States and even to the present day, so it puts us on edge in every way, right?
I think absolutely. I mean, we often associate things like eugenics and the doctor experiments with Nazis, and we sort of forget some of the U.S. history that goes along with it. And this exhibition deals with some of those issues. Where do medical ethics come from? What are the ethical implications of our own medical experiments in this country? So although a lot of the speakers are focusing on the Nazi doctors, you're going to hear a lot of themes about U.S. history as well.
Let's define eugenics, because maybe it's a term people have heard, but they don't exactly know.
Well, I think I would define eugenics as almost a kind of way to the way that people in the 19th and early 20th century tried to positively influence natural selection. Mm-hmm. And so I think the ideas of eugenics ultimately go back to Darwin's ideas of evolution, and the kind of application to that idea is to human societies. And so there are two types of eugenics, you might say. There's the attempt to prevent the breeding, for lack of a better word, of those whom experts, in the case almost always medical doctors or other medical professionals, who were deemed sort of unfit to breed or who were having a negative impact, let's say, on the social structure or society, and then encouraging those who were considered the most fit to have more and more children. So it's kind of an activist way of trying to improve society biologically.
It sounds like there is so much room for abuse. Who makes the determination about what is fit and unfit? Who's pure, who's not pure?
No, it's really scary. I think historically, when you look back, Francis Galton, who was Darwin's cousin, was sort of the father of eugenics. He came up with this idea, and his was actually a class-based eugenics. He had concerns about the lower classes, and there's something very frightening about what he was thinking about. Now, Britain fortunately did not have a state-sponsored eugenics program, though there was quite a bit of support for it from people like H.G. Wells even, you know, people you might not associate with it. But you can imagine where it's been abused in terms of race, religion, any number of things. And we've seen it this country and elsewhere.
Yeah, I was going to say it was an ideology that actually had adherence across the political spectrum early on. The Webbs, who were leading socialists in Britain, for example, as well as Germans on the left as well, or in the socialist movement in Germany as well, were supporters of eugenics. It was an ideology that crossed across what we would consider nowadays progressive as well as conservative politics. And in the United States and Britain and Germany, certainly criminality was one thing that eugenicists were very much concerned about. Again, the class issue that Amanda already raised. And then in Germany in particular, it becomes increasingly focused on race, not just necessarily Germany's Jewish population, but the relative number of Germans and Slavs in Europe, for example, was something that was causing great anxiety to eugenicists, as well as, again, the notion that the best Germans were not having enough children. And it was, again, getting back to the class idea that it was more lower working class Germans who were having large families, and this was undermining the society as a whole.
And at what point did this practice or this sorting out become part of the Nazi ideology?
Well, it's very interesting because, as Amanda has already said, eugenics is an international movement. And in Germany itself, it predates the rise of Nazism. But what, of course, both the Nazis as well as eugenic doctors realize is that there's a very nice and natural fit between these two sets of ideas. And so I would see it almost as an organic coming together of two ideologies that have somewhat disparate roots, but nevertheless mesh very well together. And certainly by the 1930s, and when the Nazi Party is poised to take power in Germany, the eugenics movement in Germany was dominated largely by conservative elements and elements who were keen to racialize eugenics and really see it as a problem of preserving the Germanic portion of Germany as much as possible against Slavs and Jews mainly, where there's the main source of anxiety for this group. And so it really was, in a way, I think the Nazis seeing something that could provide legitimate scientific expertise to their prejudices, and the eugenics community saw it as a way to get status and funding for their work. And so it was just almost a natural match.
What was happening in the States?
Well, Our eugenics program is sort of fascinating. Ours started in the 1890s, and the primary target dealt with the mentally disabled, specifically Down syndrome was a main target, though it was also used to forcibly sterilize African-American women, particularly in North Carolina, Mississippi, in the South. It's the slang you'll hear is Mississippi appendectomies. It's where women, African-American women, had surgery performed on them to have their full hysterectomy, but they were not told what was going on. This is pre-informed consent, of course. But for the U.S., we had this entire program developed. In fact, some of the German program was based on what the U.S. was doing in terms of the forcible sterilization. So if you were deemed to be unfit mentally, you could be forcibly sterilized. This was supported by a lot of parents of these children. There was sort of this fear of bad breeding, I guess you could say. Also, to some extent, by the time you get to the 60s, sort of a concern about how would their children take care of their own children. So there's sort of a mixed view of how the parents saw their role in all of this, but definitely supported by the medical community. The last forcible sterilization was in Oregon in 1980. So not that long ago when we think about it. There is, I believe it's still pending, a case in California that went to the courts in 2015 of women in prison who were forcibly sterilized. So that wouldn't be a federally sponsored program. That was a different thing. But, you know, there's still issues with it, certainly. But you have quite a few people who were sterilized during the 20th century. And, you know, even after everything that's exposed at World War II, Nazi Germany, this is still going on. In fact, really popular still in the 60s and 70s. There's some interesting articles, particularly in Indiana, when they start to outlaw forcible sterilization in the late 60s, where people are writing in saying, no, we need to bring it back. Doctors, parents, all sorts of people. We also have at the same time, which is, I think, related, the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, which, you know, is 1930s to 1972. So again, after we know what's going on in Nazi Germany, we still have this horrible experiment that's going on. African-American males who have syphilis, who are brought in, there's 600 of them. They're told they're being even cured for syphilis. It's placebo. They're studying the effects of syphilis until it gets to tertiary syphilis. And tertiary syphilis is incredibly painful. You have biological, essentially breakdown of the body, neurological difficulties, you have difficulties breathing. But the other issue you have, of course, is that because these men thought they were being cured, they're going home, having relations with their wives, and they're passing on syphilis. You have hereditary syphilis as well. So I think, you know, when you think about 1972, 1980 in this country, that feels very uncomfortable. I think we often like to think about the Nazi doctors and what they did, and this was this horrible thing over there, and it's not us. And there's a real danger in thinking about medicine in terms of national agendas, because they're all unified at this time in terms of some of their aims, particularly as Tom pointed out with the eugenics movement.
How are you then helping us to look at the different aspects of the field?
Well, I think the degree Medical and Health Humanities is part of this. This is what we're looking at, is what happens when you bring in all these different disciplines and look at it from multiple angles. I think the speaker series is doing the same thing, because we have scholars who, you know, have religious studies background, historians, doctors, ethicists, philosophers. We're running the gamut, so to speak. But I think that's the important bit, is if we take a narrow perspective of anything, it doesn't have to be just eugenics or Nazi doctors, we're missing the implications. We can, again, think of it as just those Nazi doctors. And what this series is trying to do, and I think the program more broadly, is to make us think very critically about, why is medicine the way it is? Why do we view medicine the way we do? Why are doctors trusted the way they are? And it's not to vilify doctors by any means. There's a lot of doctors supporting this, of course. It's making us to think critically about healthcare and health, something that we think we have a lot of control over. And when we start to break down the aspects of it, we realize we have very little control over health and healthcare.
Tom, how are you approaching the subject? What aspects of the question are you tackling?
Well, my talk is titled Healthcare Professionals and the Nazi Regime. And so I will be looking both at doctors primarily, but also I expect to talk about other healthcare professionals, for example, nurses. This is one of the untold, I think, or lesser told sides to the perpetration of a number of crimes in Nazi Germany, the role of nurses. Oftentimes, particularly in institutionalized settings, nurses had to take a leading role in the euthanization, in particular, of those who were deemed unfit to live. And this becomes more acute, particularly during the war and as the war is ending. So you have nurses who allow patients to starve to death or to die from dehydration, or who are administered large doses of drugs in order to kill them. And trying to kind of maybe piggybacking on what Amanda said, trying to look at the social and professional structures that allowed these professionals, whether they were nurses or doctors, to make decisions that they could find in the context morally acceptable, or at least acceptable for to still see themselves as health providers, even though they are committing acts that now we see as, of course, working that are quite gruesome and contrary to the idea of human health.
And what's another angle in this speaker series, for example, Amanda?
Well, a big issue that's going to come out in a lot of the talks is medical ethics more broadly. You know, what do we do with some of the research that came out of the Nazi doctor experiments? There are, of course, some that had, I would say, fairly no medical benefit whatsoever. I'm thinking of some of the twin experiments in particular, but others that actually have had an impact on medical care. So, you know, we have several speakers who are thinking about, you know, what good comes out of these evil acts? What do we do with this good? We have speakers who are dealing with medical ethics today. You know, how do these issues apply to how we make ethical decisions in hospital settings, in research settings in particular? I think in terms of American history, you know, there were a lot of experiments going on in the 60s and up to 70s when Institutional Research Board came about, where we didn't have informed consent from research subjects. And although we had the Nuremberg Code and we had things that the U.S. actually developed themselves to say, hey, this is what you shouldn't do, we said, well, those are for the Nazi doctors, not for us. And so you have any number of experiments, particularly, I think, the 50s and 60s into the early 70s that some of the speakers are going to talk about, because this is our history. And so, you know, there's something, I think, very frightening when you have a group that has recognized these wrongs have been perpetrated, have punished them, have come up with a code to prevent it from happening, but then ignored that own code. And I think this is not uniquely American. This is an international issue. It's just one way of getting into it. So ethics is going to be a big theme. You're going to see a lot of talks about medical ethics.
When we see the exhibition, we'll see what? Photos of labs or twins or what kinds of things? Doctors?
All of the above. It's a mixture of primary source materials. So you're going to see handwritten notes, letters, you know, documentation by the doctors. There's photographs. There's some video. And I think it's important to know that these are the actual videos and photographs from the time period. So it is going to be very disturbing. It's going to be very discomforting. I really think the things that disturb us the most are often the things we need to witness and see and learn from. So it is going to be something that, as you go through the exhibition, and it is going to go through the 30s, it begins early eugenics, it's going to go through the experiments during the war, and it's going to end with medical ethics today. So it really is going to give us this, what does it all mean? How do we make sense of this period of time, this historical element, so that we don't just say those Nazi doctors, that we say this is relevant today.
What about the arts?
There are some drawings by some of the people who were part of the experiments, and certainly we have medical drawings, and I think that should be included with art. But I'd love to see us bring some medical art to our art gallery. There's been some really interesting work, some wet art with blood, in terms of painting with blood. It's really beautiful and fascinating work that I think we could really work with quite a bit.
Did you say we have 8 weeks to take this all in?
The exhibition, you can first attend it Thursday, January 19th. That's also our first speaker. That's Rabbi Larry Kaplan from Temple Israel in Wilkes-Barre. He's speaking at 7 p.m. And then the exhibition runs through March 14th, which is a Tuesday. And that's the night that Eva Kaur is speaking at 7 p.m. in the Le Mans Theater. So all on Misericordia's campus. All the events are free. There are a couple events that require tickets. If they're in Le Mans Theater, they require tickets. That includes Dr. Kaplan, Eva Kaur, and then we have Dr. Matthew Winia and Dr. Patricia Herber-Rice on January 26th at 7 p.m. They all require tickets, but again, free. You just need to call the box office. The entire speaker series is at misericordia.edu/deadlymedicine. So it's a quick link to get to, and you can see all the different talks, all the different topics. Most of them are in the evening, 7 o'clock for most of them. There's a couple at 5 and we have 2 at noon. So there's a couple different options. So hopefully you can fit in at least one, if not many, of the talks.
Dom, what are you hoping for your students? What are you hoping for the campus and for the community with this?
Well, I think as a historian, first and foremost, is that they learn a little bit of the very recent history and maybe a part of the Second World War and the Holocaust that they're not as familiar with, because it's something that maybe other than the more sensational aspects of, say, the Mengele twin experiments, it's not something that really has appeared in our popular culture and film and media. And so I think getting them to think about another aspect, certainly of the Holocaust, is important to me. And again, I want to maybe go back to something Amanda said earlier, where she said sometimes it's the things that disturb us are the things that we need to see. And I know I always sort of stress with my students that the Holocaust, it was something that had to be perpetrated by lots of people, thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, certainly, And not all these people were monsters, and not all these people can sort of be dismissed as simply psychologically disturbed or something like that. And this idea of kind of confronting or being able to confront the fact that a highly developed, civilized society could undertake such a mass undertaking, you know, take an undertaking like this, and just sort of what that means. And I'm always inviting my students to think about, what does this mean about the possibility of, if not the exact same thing, of course, happening again, but something similar? And how do you be aware of not allowing something like this to happen again, of course, or something like it, let's just say. So certainly that's something I'm hopeful will come out of the exhibit for my students and for the broader community.
Tell us a little bit about the two speakers you mentioned, Dr. Kaplan and Ava Kaur.
Well, Dr. Kaplan is just quite frankly impressive. Tom and I both had the pleasure of hearing him speak, and he is one fantastic speaker. If I could suggest coming, come to all the talks, certainly. Everyone should come to every talk. But to have Dr. Kaplan come to campus is fantastic. He actually was supposed to come a different date and had to reschedule because the UN was giving him an award that day in Vienna. So that kind of gives you the level of Dr. Kaplan. I mean, he's published over 30 books, over 600 articles. He was the ethicist who was consulted in the Kevorkian trials in the 90s. He was voted one of the 100 most influential people in healthcare in the 20th century. And he has a PhD in philosophy and history of medicine. He's not an MD. And I think that's quite telling that he's been that influential. He's speaking about compassion for the dying and should the dying be able to access experimental drugs. So his talk is moving a little bit away from directly dealing with Nazi doctors. But what he's doing there is really thinking about what are some of the ethical implications today and what does experimental medicine look like? And that includes experimental drugs. And when we're in an age where you have considerable healthcare costs, when you have pharmaceutical costs, what does this look like? You know, ethics would be wonderful if it was just this is the right thing to do and this is the wrong thing to do. It doesn't work that way. There are all these factors, political, economic, sociological. So Dr. Kaplan's going to be speaking about that, which I think is fantastic. So we're very honored to have him coming to campus. And then Ava Kaur, this is just incredible to have her come to campus. Eva's either 84 or 85. I can't remember exactly when her birthday is. She is a survivor of the Mengele twin experiments. She and her sister made it out. Not a lot of the twins made it out. So that's quite incredible in itself. So she's coming to speak to us about forgiveness. And as I was telling my students about this talk and saying, you really need to go, this is going to be an incredible experience to hear it. And I said, I don't know if I could be that person. I'd like to think I could be that person. I don't think I could be that person. So I think to give a talk about forgiveness after everything she's been through and her sister's been through and, you know, her family died in concentration camps, her parents and a sibling. So, you know, she's been through a lot. And I think this talk about compassion and forgiveness really speaks to Misericordia's charisms quite a bit. And I think it's going to give us a different viewpoint. You know, we're looking a lot at ethical implications. We're looking a lot at the Nazi doctors. Often the talks when they deal with survivors or dealing with people who were the experiment, they may not still be around to talk about this. To have someone to speak directly about that experience and then how she's processed it after the fact, we're so incredibly honored that she's going to make it out to Misericordia.
Dr. Amanda Caleb, Associate Professor of English and Coordinator of the Speaker Series we've been hearing about, and Dr. Thomas Haikowski, Associate Professor of History at Misericordia, one of the speakers in that series, speaking with us about the Deadly Medicine Project. Misericordia University joins with the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum to offer the exhibition titled Deadly Medicine, Creating the Master Race. The traveling exhibition examines how the Nazi leadership, in collaboration with individuals in professions traditionally charged with healing and the public good, used science to help legitimize persecution, murder, and ultimately genocide. The interactive exhibition, which has been shown at the UN and around the world, will be on display through Tuesday, March 14th. It is open to the public free of charge, and it opens on Wednesday, January 18th. The speaker series will begin on the 19th, that's Thursday, at 7 with a presentation, Should Good Come Out of Evil? And that will be presented by Rabbi Larry Kaplan of Temple Israel in Wilkes-Barre. The speaker series also features presentations by Matthew Winia, who is a doctor and director of the Center for Bioethics and Humanities at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, Dr. Patricia Rice, director of the Office of the Reference Historian at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, that's January 26th, bioethicist Arthur Kaplan, Dr. Kaplan of NYU's Langone Medical Center. He will be on hand, and as we heard, that's a very special presentation on the 15th of February, Wednesday evening at 6:30 in LeMond Hall. And then on March 14th, Eva Kaur will be there. She is a Holocaust survivor, and a talk she will offer concerns forgiveness. The presentations are open, free to the public, but as we heard Dr. Caleb explain, because of the seating limitations, tickets are required for some of the events, and all you need to do is contact the Misericordia University box office to reserve tickets. And that's area code 570-674-6714. That's for the box office. And for more information on the web, misericordia.edu, MISERICORDIA, misericordia.edu. We heard from Dr. Hajkowski, and he will be speaking on Wednesday, February 22nd at 7. So the full list available online, misericordia.edu, misericordia.edu.